Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio. This is Keith Pannell, and today I'm with Professor Nino Chioca. He's the chair of neurosurgery at Brigham and Women's Hospital, associated with Harvard. Nino, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you very much. This is great.
Well, I hope it will be. I'm looking forward to this discussion. Now, before we get on to your expertise in neurosurgery and brain cancer and all the things that are affiliated with that, tell us, how did a nice fellow like you become a scientist? What were those moments when you were a little toddler? You were in Padua, Italy, I think, at the beginning or somewhere close.
Yeah, I grew up in Italy, in the northeast part of Italy, and science always fascinated me. I don't know why that was so. I was always interested in test tubes and chemical reactions.
Test tubes as a young boy?
As a young boy.
Not Beatles or stars?
No, my chemistry set. I remember they gave me a chemistry set, and I was just playing around with the test tubes and looking at things, adding one liquid to another liquid and seeing different colors develop.
All right.
And so I just always enjoyed it. And then,
did your parents encourage this? I mean, was there
they did.
A guide to this sort of
thing? Yeah, no, my parents were – there was absolutely no scientists or medical people in my family, but my dad thought it was great. He thought it was a good idea, and in fact, he's the one that – said, you should become a doctor or a scientist or something like that.
And so that you
that's
you
what I did.
It, right?
Being the firstborn, I followed my parents' advice.
In Italy in those days, there was more of if it's anything like Britain in the same period, you actually did much more what your parents suggested that you do in cahoots with school teachers.
Definitely.
Right?
Definitely.
You weren't quite as free to make decisions on your own as you would be in North America.
Correct. And I think it was life there, there were not as many possibilities because always economic crises. We're talking about the 1960s, 1970s in Italy. And really you were just hoping to just find one way in which to make a living. What are you going to do to make a living? You did not have as much opportunity to think widely and about different areas.
It's just to
when
get
your dad told, when your dad told me, you should become a doctor, you just did it.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
So how did you become a doctor? I mean, you obviously left Italy.
Yeah, we left Italy. We came here in El Paso, and I came to UTEP, and I knew I wanted to go into medicine, but oddly enough, I always still had this love for science and research, and I remember meeting you in a chemistry class, and then being offered to do some work in your
undergraduate
laboratory.
Right. Yeah.
And I just loved it. I loved being there in the lab, tinkering with...
So if you hadn't have had that experience, you would have gone maybe straight to an MD? Because as I didn't point out to the audience, you have an MD-PhD, which is one of those rarefied double degrees.
Correct.
So if you hadn't had that exposure, perhaps you would have just gone straight MD?
I think so. I think, I would have more likely than not just did a straight MD, but I wanted to really keep my hands into the laboratory, into the science piece of medicine.
So tell us then, neurosurgery, you're the chair of neurosurgery.
Yes.
One question straight away, are you a surgeon? Do you actually do surgery?
I do. I don't do as much as I used to because I have to regulate, administer, and make sure that everybody else in my area, in my unit, in my department is behaving and doing the right things for patients. And so I have a lot more meetings, a lot more strategy sessions, and but I do keep my hands in the operating room, definitely.
Well, when you say that, I know my wife has a pilot's license. And so you have to do a certain amount to maintain your credibility.
Yeah.
So what's the minimum you can get away with in terms of brain surgery, for goodness sake?
Well, I've become super specialized. So I primarily do brain tumors.
Okay.
So I'll do about 2 to 3 a week.
Oh, okay. So, and sometimes they can last a long time.
Yeah, so Tuesday is my operating room day. So on Tuesdays, I operate all day.
All day? So it's like from one patient to
from
another.
7:30 to about 6 or 7, yeah. So I'll do about 2 to 3 tumors.
And you don't get at the end of that. I mean, you're getting shaky. I don't
No. Absolutely.
I'm glad. But it seems that's a lot of time in sort of one constant flow.
It's like everything. You're used to it. You've trained so long.
Yeah,
to do it, and it's a repetitive manual. There's some intellect in it, but it's always very similar to what I've done. So it's just like flying a plane. After you've flown so many hours, so many days, you know exactly what to do.
Just got to make sure there's no gas.
It becomes, yeah, exactly. You know, every once in a while you have to make something unexpected happens, but you're trained, you know, what to do with the unexpected.
Do you see the patients very often? Or is it just that, you know, you've got Tuesday set aside, you've got all these other responsibilities, then on Tuesday you go in and you see your workload and you see patient A, B, and C, and this is it, this is the background, this is the MRI. You know the brain better than the person in the end?
Yes. You know, so we, what usually happens is with brain tumors, you have to see patients right away. It's, you know, you cannot tell them if you get a call, you cannot say to tell somebody, oh yeah, I've got free time 2 weeks from now. People want to be seen right away. So if I'm available, and I try to be available, I'll try to see them the next day, you know, within 24 hours. And you know, we have, our clinic is right there, so they just come to clinic, and it takes me, you know, we look at the scans together with the patient, we decide what to do. People think of brain tumors as something malignant, but there's various types of brain tumors. There are some brain tumors that are very, very benign, for which we actually don't do anything about. We just follow them. And there are some that are very malignant. And then there's a whole spectrum in between of some tumors that behave initially benign and then more malignant. And there's various behaviors that these tumors utilize and how they affect the patient.
We'll go into that because there's some interesting aspects to that. Let's take a benign tumor.
Right.
I mean, and it seems to me benign simply means probably it's growing very slowly. I mean, would that be the first sort of definition?
Yeah, so one example is a tumor called a meningioma. It's a very common tumor, relatively common. It is actually a tumor that arises from the sac, the membrane that surrounds the brain, okay? And these tumors, for the most part, are very benign, grow really, really slowly. Sometimes they'll grow for a bit and then stop growing. In a lot of cases.
So they're growing almost outside the brain if they're in this.
Yeah,
this
so they sac, grow they grow outside the brain and they push inside and push towards the brain.
So when you say push, I mean, it's just that they're growing, but they're not sort of penetrating with roots into the brain.
No, they just displace the brain.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so that could have very, very slow health impact, right?
I mean, right. And one of the interesting things about the brain is if you give it enough time, it will accommodate. Okay. You know, so so with very slow growth, you know, the brain allows the tumor to grow and will accommodate it up to a certain point.
They call it a sort of a plastic sort of organ, right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, it can retrace new steps for information transfer.
Correct.
I tell my students, I said, look, just give it time. Your brain will finally say, God, this chemistry is good stuff.
Yes.
Right? But you've got to give it a chance, right?
Correct.
So those sorts of tumors, then, you would probably not normally operate on those?
Yeah. So for those tumors, we usually, if they're small and not causing symptoms,
right,
we usually follow them, and we would operate only if we see them grow on serial MRI scans. So we will get MRI scans every so often, and if there's evidence that they're growing, then we will take them out because sooner or later they'll start having an effect.
How do people know they've got them? I mean, is it headaches? I mean, is that simple?
Sometimes, sometimes, you know, nowadays there's so many MRI scans or CAT scans, everybody, you know, any time you have a headache or bump your head, somebody's getting a scan. So a lot of times it's really incidental. They're red herrings. You know, I saw a lady actually right before I came here who developed an infection in her ear and lost her earring. You know, she cannot hear anymore. And so somebody got a scan and they saw a little meningioma on the other side of the brain. So they got worried that this was the reason why she lost her hearing. So I had to reassure her that was not the reason. This is totally incidental, and we're just going to follow this. We're just going to get MRI scans.
I mean, it's not easy to tell someone, oh, you've got this little brain tumor, but don't worry about it, dear. You've got bigger problems than that.
You've got bigger problems than that, yeah.
Well, one of the things I think I learned listening to people talk about tumors is that to an ingenue like myself, you think, well, there's the tumor, and you think it's pretty homogeneous. All right, but when you actually start to look at, let's say, the genomics or the material that's in there, they're not homogeneous at all.
Yeah, and I think what we've learned is that the more benign the tumor, the more homogeneous it is.
Okay.
You know? So when a tumor is very benign, clearly something happened to make the tumor grow. something happening to its DNA. The DNA is like the software programming of the cell, but it probably was something that has not carried out. There have not been multiple genetic changes. It's probably just been one or two at most. As you progress and become more malignant, these tumors accumulate hundreds and hundreds of mutations. You know, their DNA gets completely messed up, if you want to talk about it. And as it does that, it becomes very heterogeneous. In other words, as you said, one area of a tumor may be very different from another area of the tumor when you sample it.
In one sense, you'd say that would make it more prone to be treatable because you don't have just one focus for, you know, how to treat it with chemotherapy or radiation or whatever. But is that also like a brain in itself, that you can destroy one part of this tumor, but the other part will just accommodate and sort of carry gaily on its way?
Yeah, no, so now, unfortunately, what happens is when it's so different, when one area is different from the other, you can treat it, but then the other area of the tumor actually is not getting treated, so actually will grow faster, will grow more. And that's why these tumors become so resistant to therapies. And so that's why single therapy with one drug doesn't work. And you start putting two drugs and you start adding radiation. But these tumor cells, the more malignant ones, such as glioblastoma, this is the most malignant form of brain cancer, they really adapt. They know how to escape all the drugs we give them. And these are very smart cancer cells.
And so what's the sort of the lifetime of a patient that comes in with one of those really nasty malignant?
Yeah, so, you know, we play averages. And, you know, the average actually is more like the median. The median is 50% of patients live longer and 50% live shorter, is about 15 months. But when I tell patients that, I say, okay, this is a number. And you're a person, and you're different from a number, from an average. And we actually don't know. As I said, there are some patients that live much longer than that. I've had patients live 3, 4, 5 years. I've had a patient that has been 8 years out now.
Let's assume that you get diagnosed with one of these nasty little buggers. And then, you know, the first resource is surgery first or chemo first or radiation. I mean, how does the decision process work?
Yeah, so if it can be taken out, the data shows that surgery is really the first step in prolonging your life. Going to a neurosurgical center that knows how to do these and has done lots of these would be the first good set step. Afterwards, it's good to have that tissue, test the tissue. We now do genetic analyses of some of these tumors to see if it's one, if it's a type of tumor that behaves better than others.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we test for some.
What do you mean behaves better?
Some of these glioblastomas tend to make patients live longer. So if you have certain genetic mutations, they seem to have better biology. They grow, they respond to the drugs better. They don't grow as fast.
Okay, so there's a range within even these nasty types.
There's even a range within these nasty ones.
You're listening to Science Studio. My name is Keith Pannell, and today's guest is Professor Nino Chioca. He's the chair of neurosurgery at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. That's associated with Harvard University up there in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Most of us know the MMR vaccine protects against measles, mumps, and rubella. Yet most people don't know Maurice Hillman.
Some say he saved more lives than any other scientist in the 20th century by either creating or working on more than 25 vaccines, including 9 of the 14 that are recommended for children today.
Not bad for a man whose original career goal was to manage a JCPenney store. Instead, he earned a PhD in microbiology before spending his career at the drug giant Merck. His combination of scientific talent and get-it-done attitude made him ideal for vaccine development.
You could see that in his work on the MMR vaccine. At the time, the measles vaccine carried significant side effects, which discouraged some people from getting it. So Hillman, along with a pediatrician, minimized the effects by giving the vaccine along with a shot that temporarily boosted the immune system.
Over the next several years, he developed a safer strain of measles virus still used in today's vaccine. Around the same time, he also began working on the mumps and rubella vaccines.
A strain of the rubella virus had spread around the world, killing 11,000 newborns in the U.S. and causing birth defects in 20,000 infants. Soon after refining a safe rubella vaccine, he combined it with the measles and mumps vaccines to create the MMR vaccine.
Today, it's given with the varicella vaccine to protect against chickenpox, which Dr. Hillman also helped develop along with vaccines for hepatitis A and B, meningitis, and pneumonia.
By now, you can appreciate the worldwide impact of this one scientist, whose legacy is for us to be protected from infectious diseases.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discoveries shape the future of medicine. For much more on this and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio, Keith Pannell, Professor Nino Chioca, the Chair of Neurosurgery at Brigham and Women's Hospital in associated with Harvard University in the Northeast. We were talking, Nino, about these different types of tumor and the fact that the more virulent, the much less treatable, obviously that's one thing, and the more heterogeneous they are.
Yeah.
That there's just bits of DNA in this part that have been mutated this way and another part in that way. How does that happen? Is there a simple understanding of why they have developed in that way?
There's an entire area of science now that's trying to understand that. And interestingly, if we take lessons from completely different areas of science, like population dynamics, population archaeology, the best way I could put it is once we were monkeys, right? Once we were hominids, as we know, as the hominids procreated and produced and humanity advanced, there were several lines of humanity that died out, right? And there were others that that continued. But then there were differences, and so some of them were in Africa, some of them were in the Middle East, some of them were in England, some of them came to the States.
I don't think we ever had monkeys in England, but never mind. Go on.
So if you look at our DNA, it's very similar, but there are differences. There clearly are differences. And so if I look at your DNA, because you're Anglo-Saxon from England, and I look at the DNA from somebody that's was an aborigines from Australia, there are differences. But we all derive from one original.
But I mean, I've read somewhere, and I may be wrong, something like 99% of all of us, all of us have about 99% DNA in common. So that little 1% that makes for the diversity.
And that's what happens with these tumors, that 1% of diversity. So there was an original primordial tumor cell that formed these tumors. But as these tumor cells grew, divided, created daughter and son tumor cells, they all became a little bit different. And they occupy different regions of the tumor. And that's why a tumor cell in one area may be 99% similar to the tumor cell in another area, but it's that 1% difference that becomes the key on how they behave differently.
Well, talking about our DNA, I mean, it's like space. You know, there's something called dark matter. Turns out we only know a small amount of where all the material is in space.
Yeah.
And it turns out in our own genetic makeup, most of it we don't quite know exactly what the function of the DNA is.
Yeah.
And so there's this term, junk DNA. Talk to us a little bit and how junk DNA is a variable from one species to another.
There was an initial sequence of DNA that was performed in 2000. And one of the things we learned is that out of these 3 billion sequences, a sequence of DNA is like the software, the programming software of our cell, of our body. So out of these 3 billion sequences, very little was dedicated to what makes us. You know, the information that's contained in that very small amounts of DNA is directly relates to your eye color, the shape of your hands, how you think, the color of your hair. Very little was dedicated to that. And when you looked at it, there was very little difference between that amount of DNA between us, man, and, for example, that of a very simple species like a molluscum or a fly. Okay. What made us very different was all the other DNA that did not seem to directly relate to your eye color, to the shape of your face, to how you thought. And this was called junk DNA. we have so much more of that junk DNA than all other species. And so now we're looking in more depth into this junk DNA. And what we're finding out, this is actually the good stuff. This is the stuff that makes us different. This is the stuff that tells DNA to turn on or turn off at the right time, under the right circumstances. This is the regulation. These are the control areas. And so we have many more sophisticated controls to keep our genes, to switch them on and off at the right time.
So would I be correct in thinking a big thrust of modern research is to now begin to tease out the functions of all those little bits of junk and
correct.
What it's regulating, what it's turning on and off, et cetera?
Correct. And it's a very complex system, as you can imagine, because there's a lot of interactions, there's a lot of regulation. And it changes. It changes with time, changes during the lifetime of an individual, and it changes from organ to organ. Yeah. And so it's a really complex.
Do you wonder that we've evolved? We're so complicated, right?
It is amazing how we have evolved,
right.
If you think about, you know.
And how quick is that evolution? I mean, how far back can we go and look at human DNA? I know that you read stories about they've just dug up Richard III in a parking lot in the middle of England, and they sort of proved it's him by getting some DNA from bone material or something. Can you say, you know, in 600 years, can you see any transformations of different forms of DNA in a family?
I don't think we can predict the future, but we can look at the past.
Right.
And you can definitely see and changes in over a period of hundreds of years. You can see small changes.
So definitely. Evolution isn't quite the long-term process that we sort of think about.
Correct. I mean, well, I think the longer you look back, the more the changes, right?
Well, tell us then, how does this junk DNA, this regulation DNA, how does that impact you as a neurosurgeon that's thinking of treating cancers?
Well, you know, we are now putting a lot of effort in taking out brain cancers, having the tissue, and then sequence the tissue to look at the genes that are mutated, you know, and why are they making this cancer. The hope is that once we know that, then we can figure out the drugs to give patients. But thinking more forward, it is likely that that will not be enough because we're not sequencing, we're not looking at the junk DNA, the DNA that regulates and transforms. And my worry, my concern is that as we go forward, we will find that we will need to do something about stopping that regulation or changing that regulation to really make sure that the cancer never comes back.
So is that part of the research program that you guys are all doing?
Yes. So we are looking into one particular area of this junk DNA. This is called microRNA. MicroRNAs are really very small snippets of information. They are made throughout this area of the junk DNA. And what they do is actually they turn on and off genes based on different physiological conditions. So, for example, if the cell is in the presence, or if the tumor cell has a lot of nutrients, these microRNAs will turn off some of the genes that are needed to use up those nutrients so you don't use up these nutrients as much. If there's not enough nutrients, these microRNAs will turn on the genes that will kind of like try to get as much nutrients as possible.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. We did a program several years ago about ants.
Yeah.
And it turns out in the biosphere that was over here in Tucson, they quantified all the ants that were there at the beginning. And then it came back 4 years later, and all those other species of ants had gone. There's only one. And it wasn't one that they even knew was there in the first place.
Yeah.
And what it was about these particular ants is their communication.
Yeah.
Right? They had this very sophisticated chemical factory to make far more chemicals to leave down on the trail and would say, for example, hey, there's lots of food. Take your time. Just follow the route. And as the amount of nutrient went down, right, then the signal got more complicated. Well, it's not as much as there was. Maybe some of you should go look in east, west, north, and south. And then towards the end, hey, look, there's nothing left. Don't worry going here. Go somewhere else. I mean, it's the same concept.
Exactly the same concept.
Right.
So tumor cells are behaving like ants.
Yeah.
And the ones that have this more sophisticated microRNA control are the ones that are the survivors in the tumor.
Yeah.
And that's why if we can understand how to disrupt that, I think will give us a leg up in destroying
the What's
the tumor.
Biggest sort of insight that you've in your own research now program? Because you're not just a surgeon. You've got the MD, PhD. Yeah. So you're a researcher too. Over 200 papers, something like that. What's the biggest surprise and the most beautiful thing that you've sort of discovered in basic research?
I think this role of microRNA in glioblastoma biology, it's a field that we only got into in the last 5 years. I think it's been very rewarding because it's been the most biological project that I've had. It's been the most basic biological project. I mean, there clearly are some translational qualities to it, but it's really an area of cancer biology that was very unexplored before we got into it. Most of the other research work that we're doing seems very exciting because we're looking at how to find new drugs and new ways of treating these tumors. But it's very translational. It's more like, let's find a drug, let's test it to see if it kills a tumor, let's test it in animals, then we'll test it in people. It's important research, but there's not a lot of creativity and intellect into it. So I think that
there's a lot of screening.
There's a lot of screening.
Get your cells and right? Dump in chemical.
It's called discovery science.
Right. Yeah.
Rather than hypothesis-driven science. And so I think this microRNA project I'm telling you about is very novel, new. And it's really opening up an entire area of biology that a lot of people don't know about. And so I think that's been the most important discovery that I can think of.
Yeah, because that leads in. We really don't have enough time to get into this. But, I mean, your description of when you discover that someone has a tumor, you go in, you hopefully remove it. But then you also, you know, do a biopsy on this. Mm-hmm. You find out what is its chemical, biochemical mm-hmm. makeup. And you also take some of the, what I might call the healthy tissue very close to that mm-hmm. particular tumor. Mm-hmm. So you can then begin to test, you know, the drug against the bad stuff mm-hmm. and make sure it doesn't do any harm to the good
right.
stuff. So, I mean, that's where this concept of personal DNA, personal medicine, is that really on the horizon?
That is on the horizon. I think we're learning that we cannot treat populations that have a disease like they are all homogeneous and therefore one drug fits all.
Right.
That has been the way we've carried out medicine until now. And I'm not just talking about cancer. I'm talking about diabetes, hypertension. And we know there's a lot of variation amongst populations, amongst individuals. And as we understand these variations, we understand the genetics and the epigenetics of these variations. It may be that the drug to treat hypertension that works for you may not work for somebody else.
Right.
And we need to look for something, sort of a different drug or a different chemical to treat that other person.
Right.
And, so it's becoming more personalized.
Nino Kiyoka, professor and chair of neurosurgery at the Brigham and Women's Hospital and associated with Harvard Medical School in the Northeast. It's been a pleasure to have you back
Thank
in El Paso
so
for a little bit.
It's great to be at UTEP again.
Well, I'm glad you and come more often. And if I ever get a tumor, I've got your number.
I appreciate it.
And I'd like to thank the audience out there. And, of course, we thank, as usual, Norma Martinez for putting this together. It never sounds quite the same as until she's put it together. And we'll be back next week with another Science Studio. Thank you very much. Adios.
I'm Noemi Rojas with your Synapse Flash. 2 weeks remain to register for the region's first ever Biomed Symposium. It will bring researchers together with physicians of all specialties for the purpose of kick-starting medical innovation in the region. Biomed takes place in El Paso, October 26th. Learn more and register at mcabiomed.com.